This is May 8th, 2016, and I'm going to read from an article called The Virtue of Hard Things. It's basically a review of a book called Grit by Angela Duckworth. And this this review is by an Emily Esfahani Smith. This is from May 3rd, last week. Most people would think of John Irving as a gifted wordsmith. He is the author of best-selling novels celebrated for their Dickensian plots, including The Cider House Rules and The World According to Garp. But Mr. Irving has severe dyslexia, was a C-minus English student in high school, and scored 475 out of 800 on the SAT verbal test. How, then, did he have such a remarkably successful career as a writer? Angela Duckworth argues that the answer is grit, which she defines as a combination of passion and perseverance in the pursuit of a long-term goal. The author, a psychology professor at the University of Pennsylvania, has spent the last decade studying why some people have extraordinary success and others do not. Grit is a fascinating tour of the psychological research on success and also tells the stories of many gritty exemplars, from New York cartoon editor Bob Mankoff, who submitted some 2,000 drawings to the magazine before one was accepted, to actor Will Smith, who explains his success as follows. "The only thing that I see that is distinctly different about me is I'm not afraid to die on a treadmill. If we get on the treadmill together, there's two things. You're getting off first, or I'm going to die." As for Mr. Irving, though verbal fluency did not come easily to him as a young man, what he lacked in aptitude he made up for in effort. In school, if his peers allotted 1 hour to an assignment, he devoted two or three. As a writer, he works very slowly, constantly revising drafts of his novels. And then he said, "In doing something over and over again, something that was never natural becomes almost second nature." So you know where I'm going with this in terms of practice. It's why they call it practice. It's the consistency, the persistence, day in and day out, week after week, month after month, year after year, that brings results. This article and the book that it's reviewing should be a great encouragement to people who do not feel particularly talented. I first felt this sense of encouragement when I applied to college, and my grades were not great. My SAT scores were mediocre, but somehow the University of Michigan admissions council or whatever somehow I got the sense from them that they accepted me because of the some other test where some kind of test that measures persistence or perseverance. That's although few of us are gifted, just by definition, we all have this capacity to just buckle down and stick with something. That's the word we used to use when we were in the old days, was a stick-to-itiveness. So much comes from that. I love these words of Calvin Coolidge. He said, "Nothing in the world can take the place of persistence. Talent will not. Nothing is more common than unsuccessful men with talent. Genius will not. Unrewarded genius is almost a proverb. Education will not. The world is full of educated derelicts. Persistence and determination alone are omnipotent." And that this just sprang to mind, that phrase, 10% inspiration and 90% perspiration. I know that to everyone or almost anyone hearing this Taisho, you know that. You know it at some level. This is like so many things in Taisho. I'm preaching to the choir. But I think it doesn't hurt to be reminded of it, especially people who may feel at times discouraged, or they don't see much in the way of results from their practice. I think it doesn't hurt to hear something like this, which is just one of many sources that give evidence of the all importance of persistence, perseverance. Something that was never natural becomes almost second nature. We've learned over the years that there is this window of time after someone comes to a workshop and they start practicing where if they can just keep it up long enough, and that can vary, of course, with a person, 2 weeks, 4 weeks, if you can just keep it up long enough, then they'll start to see the benefits of it. And seeing the benefits is the strongest encouragement to keep going and to even increase sitting. But it is such a demanding practice. It demands so much self-discipline, especially when you're sitting on your own, alone, at home. You don't have the support of sitting with others, although now with this live streaming, I've heard a lot of positive feedback from people out in the hinterlands who do derive a real sense of support and working together when they sit and they can hear us sitting, like right now, and during the Taisho even. So we have the tools now where you don't have to feel so alone and you're out there. Everything, any kind of skill, in the beginning, you feel at odds with it. Just starting with the physical posture, the cross-legged posture or any posture, sitting absolutely still for 35 minutes at a time, who takes to that immediately? It's most of us struggle with it, and that's where the grit comes in, is to even in the face of the difficulty of it and how unnatural it feels, if we can keep at it long enough, then it becomes almost second nature. It's all a question of of persevering long enough that we integrate it into the body and it starts to, yes, become second nature. The author of this review continues, Ms. Duckworth first realized the importance of grit as a teacher. Before she became an academic, she worked as a seventh grade math teacher at a public school in New York. Some of her students were more inherently gifted with numbers than others. But not all of these capable students, to her surprise, got the best grades. Those who did weren't always, quote, math people. For the most part, they were those who consistently invested time and effort in their work. Ms. Duckworth decided to become a research psychologist to figure out what explained their success. One of her first studies was of West Point cadets. Every year, West Point enrolls more than 1,000 students, but 20% of cadets drop out before graduation. Many quit in their first 2 months during an intense training program known as Beast Barracks, or BEAST. The most important factor in West Point admissions is the whole candidate score, a composite measure of test scores, high school rank, leadership potential, and physical fitness. But Ms. Duckworth found that this score, which is essentially a measure of innate ability, did not predict who dropped out during BEAST. She created her own grit scale, scored using cadets' responses to statements like, I finish whatever I begin, or new ideas and projects sometimes distract me from previous ones. Those who scored highest on the grit scale were the most likely to make it to the end of BEAST. It's a similar story among the other groups that Ms. Duckworth writes about here, including spelling bee champions and sales associates. Grit predicts their success more robustly than innate ability. And there is no positive correlation between ability and grit. There is no positive correlation between ability and grit. A study of Ivy League undergraduates even showed that the smarter the students were, as measured by SAT scores, the less gritty they were. I once heard that Shunryu Suzuki Roshi, the founding abbot of the San Francisco Zen Center, once said, I became a Zen teacher not because I was particularly good at this. It's just that I stayed around the longest. Everyone else left, he said. Now the danger, I suppose, that it says that some people could hear this and say, well, I'm just not really endowed with much grit. I'm not one of those people who has much perseverance. But this is just nonsense. And this is why. Because none of us is stuck with any particular characteristics. We develop grit. We can develop it. And I can't think of a better way than through meditation practice. We change. That's the whole point of any physical discipline, is we have a way of changing, refining and strengthening our character and our personality. We're not stuck with a self of any particular characteristics. And as we just heard, we're not just fortunate because of certain talent or ability. And this is also true of faith. Some people, when they are new to practice, they tell themselves, "Well, I don't have strong faith. I'm kind of." I heard one person say, "I'm long on doubt, short on faith." But faith is not a fixed characteristic. You develop it. It grows through persistent practice. So it's just this crucial measure of just being able to stick it out, stick with it, keep it going, even when you don't feel you're getting anywhere. If you could see results every day, that doesn't take grit to persist and under those conditions. You're getting positive feedback all the time. The measure of grit is to persevere in the face of no apparent progress. Granted, some people seem to come to practice with more of that. Some people start college with more of that than others, but it's not a fixed quantity. She continues, "Grit may be defined by strenuous effort, but what drives that work, Ms. Duckworth finds, is passion. And a great service of Ms. Duckworth's book is her down-to-earth definition of passion. To be gritty, an individual doesn't need to have an obsessive infatuation with a goal. Rather, he needs to show consistency over time." That's in quotation marks. It's a great phrase to understand. Consistency over time. The grittiest people have developed long-term goals and are constantly working toward them. She writes, "Enthusiasm is common, endurance is rare." Long-term goals. The best goal we can have is complete, perfect enlightenment. That's much better than just having a goal of Kensho, a first awakening experience, or getting through one's koan. You don't need that short-term goal of Kensho or getting through one's koan if you keep your sights on attaining the Great Way of Buddha. Attaining the Great Way of Buddha, as we say in the fourth of our four bodhisattva vows. In the earlier years of my time here, I noticed that a surprising number of people, after being passed on their first koan, would drift away from the center. I read somewhere some research in psychology that the more emphasis is placed on any goal, the more likely you'll quit after attaining the goal. And I think it's fair to say that Roshi Kapila put a lot of emphasis on that first experience of Kensho, getting through one's koan. There's no need to make that such a important thing if we look past it and just see that our real goal is attaining the Great Way of Buddha, that we already are, becoming what we already are, but fully. And this involves this long-term goal, the ultimate long-term goal of reaching Buddhahood, and also, of course, involves working on our defilements, our habit forces that keep tripping us up. And that's not anything that's going to be accomplished in one lifetime. If you look very strictly at these things that bedevil us, ways of reacting to people and situations, all the many forms of greed, ill will, and delusion. That's a project to work on. Enthusiasm is common, endurance is rare. How many people can catch on fire but how many people can maintain that, even as a steady burning fire? Here too, we've seen over so many years of practice here that there are people who start off with a bang. They really catch fire. They come right out of a workshop, out of the starting blocks, and they tear like crazy into great enthusiasm about sitting, and then sputter out. Other people are the opposite. They take them a while to get going, but they keep coming back to it. They keep falling away from practice, and some need is more powerful, a need to come back and pick it up again and keep going. And then sometimes those slow starters really gather steam as they go on, and they last much longer than the ones who burn so brightly at the beginning and fizzle out. But even fizzling out is never an end in any way. There's never really any ultimate failure. You always have the opportunity to go back and resume. There's a saying from the island of Crete that I've sometimes quoted in Sesshin: return where you have failed, leave where you have succeeded. Leave where you have succeeded. Never settle into any kind of self-satisfaction, any complacency. Any victories, so-called victories, are just partial victories. We see evidence of grit in anyone who has completed college, maybe even especially people who went on to higher degrees, anyone who has a PhD or an MD, any kind of advanced degree. You can't get there without perseverance. We see it in marriage. A long marriage is evidence of perseverance, because inevitably in any marriage or long-term partnership there are bumps in the road, there are quarrels and disagreements, and yet the marriage vows are to stick it out when you feel like fleeing. This is not an absolute. I don't buy this thing until that the person we marry is absolutely always someone we have to stick it out with. Why? Because people change. In a marriage, both people are changing all the time. We're all changing all the time. And so what may have been a really strong, viable connection in the beginning can change. People can drift apart. They can find themselves going in different directions, and that would be time to really bear down and see if there's really if it's something that there can be no reconciliation. If not, then at its best, divorce then becomes a way of just acknowledging the karma has exhausted itself between those two people. That happens. It's a fantasy to think that the person we marry is absolutely always the person we have to stick with for life. But then, on the other hand, there is the commitment. Commitment is hugely important in anything. In marriage, it's commitment that carries you through these difficult periods. And that's what's so difficult to discern when you've had repeated differences with your partner and question whether you should stay together, is how to know when that's something that's really valid, legitimate, exhausting your mutual karma with your karma with one another as in partnership, and when it's just any of the things that can irritate you about your partner. It's the same with practice. Just because we start Zen practice doesn't mean that is absolutely the best practice for us forever. People find other ways, and those need to be honored if as long as the move away from, in this case, Zen practice, is not just an avoidance mechanism. That's always a possibility, and anyone who's really examining herself or himself in such times has to consider that as a possibility. Am I just running to avoid facing myself? No one can answer that for you. You have to determine that yourself. In terms of going through dark periods of in marriage or practice, spiritual practice, periods of growth are almost always preceded by times in which it seems like things are getting worse. There's a pattern of decline or disorganization before there is growth and expansion. There's that very common saying, the night is always darkest right before the dawn. It's common, widely known expression, because it's true. There are many cases of people on the verge of a breakthrough, awakening or breakthrough, who feel despair. And there is where perseverance is called for, to find your way through that darkness. Koan practice, Koans demand this perseverance and throw up before us this barrier that forces us to either persevere or flee. There's this wonderful analogy in that Shibayama Roshi in the Zen Comments on the Mumonkan quoted from someone else. He said, "Suppose here is a completely blind man who trudges along leaning on his stick and depending on his intuition. the role of the koan is to mercilessly take the stick away from him and to push him down after turning him around. Now the blind man has lost his sole support and will not know where to go or how to proceed. He will be thrown into the abyss of despair. In this same way, the koan will mercilessly take away all our intellect and knowledge. In short, the role of the koan is not to lead us to Satori easily, but on the contrary, to make us lose our way and drive us to despair. So that's when it's really working, is when you're feeling discouraged, lost, and that's where grit is absolutely essential. How else are you going to get through feeling of despair, discouragement, being lost, other than persevering? I always think of Aitken Roshi as the poster boy of grit. He writes in one of his books that he spent 26 years working on Mu, not all that time with real diligence. In the earlier years, it was kind of on and off, but he logged in 26 years working on it before he was passed on Mu. The thing is, that's not wasted time. Just because you haven't entered the first gate, as we sometimes call it, doesn't mean you're not getting a lot out of it. He must have seen evidence of change in himself, that he did persevere all that time. You can't lose, really. Even if you never resolve your first koan, it's all benefit. It's practice. I'll resume reading from this review. This raises a question: what if someone doesn't feel particularly passionate about anything? Ms. Duckworth's research focuses on children, and she does not shy away from dispensing advice to adults on how to cultivate passion in kids. If children aren't overscheduled or under the shadow of a hovering parent, chances are that they will naturally develop some interests, and an adult's role is to give them the time and support to explore these interests. When Jeff Bezos was in middle school, for example, he was constantly inventing mechanical gizmos. His mother took him to Radio Shack, sometimes four times in one day, to help him get parts. Well, you see the enormously important role of the parents have in monitoring, watching, noticing their kids. That's the first challenge, is being there for them, noticing what directions they are moving toward, and then encouraging that or supporting that. She continues, but even preternaturally gifted people reach a point where their talent is not enough. Here, the second part of grit, perseverance, becomes critically important. Adults must expect the children in their care to see their interests through. Ms. Duckworth tells the story of NFL quarterback Steve Young, who had a disappointing first semester on the Brigham Young football team and wanted to come home. His father told him, "You can quit, but you can't come home because I'm not going to live with a quitter." This sounds very harsh. Yet Ms. Duckworth cites research showing that when adults set high expectations while also providing support, kids respond by upping their game. So it was with Young. He said, "It was tough, but it was loving." Young stayed on, eventually winning an award for best collegiate quarterback. This is one of the essential measures of a Zen teacher, also meditation teacher, is to expect much of the student. Not what is beyond the immediate reach of the student, but again, if you look at the goal of full enlightenment, then that's what you know a student is capable of. You know it because you've seen that that is the student's essential nature. Enlightenment is their essential nature. Sometimes I've had senior students express gratitude for my patience, my faith in them. It's nothing to have, once you've seen that they're already in their nature endowed with this enlightened nature, then that's not faith, it's knowing. It's knowing that everyone has this is equally endowed with this enlightened nature. And that every time the teacher rings his handbell, rejecting the answer of a student, it is testimony to the teacher's faith in the student. This was also very encouraging when I figured this out, because I could get so down on myself when I would present an answer in Doksan and Roshi would send me out with a ring of the bell, and I with great epiphany when I realized that every time he didn't accept an answer, every time he rang that bell to send me back to do more work, he was showing faith in me. It's true. A teacher who would dish out answers to the student, and unfortunately there are just too many of them. I think there are a growing number of Zen teachers who the student will present an answer. I've heard this from secondhand sources who then just said, "No, that's not it. This is it," and they'll show how to demonstrate the koan. Now that's a teacher who doesn't have faith in the student. And then one last paragraph of this article: in her own home, Ms. Duckworth has instituted the hard thing rule, capital H, capital T, capital R. She, her husband, and their two teenagers commit themselves to one difficult activity that they choose and that requires daily practice. They cannot quit until there is a natural stopping point, like the end of the season. For one daughter, it's playing the viola. For the other, it's piano. The point of the hard thing rule is not for her daughters to become professional musicians, but for them to learn how to follow through. had another source of material related to this, but I think it's better not to start it now. And now we'll stop and recite the four vows. No, this is not the one I was looking at. It's the one I parked back behind me on this town. Story about, this is from The Man of Many Qualities, A Legacy of the I Ching. And this comes from China. And I think it speaks for itself. The son of an aging housebreaker decided that it was about time for him to learn the profession to support the family. So he asked his father for lessons. The father approved the proposal and took him along on their next break-in attempt. They broke through a fence, stealthily entered a mansion, and opened a large chest. The father suggested that the son step into the chest and pick out the valuables, whereupon the son did. As soon as he got in, the father dropped the lid, locked the chest, sneaked out into the courtyard, loudly knocked on the door, waking the whole household, and quickly retired through the hole in the fence. The excited residents scurried around with their candles and discovered that the thief had gotten away. Meanwhile, the son, imprisoned in the chest, was terribly afraid. An idea flashed through his mind. He made a scratching noise like a mouse, at the sound of which the master of the family sent the maid to investigate. When the maid unlocked the chest, out jumped the boy, who blew out the candle, pushed the maid aside, and ran off with the neighbors on his heels. Passing a well, he lit upon a second thought. He picked up a large stone and dropped it into the well with a loud splash. Hearing the sound, the pursuers all gathered around the deep and dark hole, attempting to see the burglar drowning himself. The boy ran on. Safely back home, the youngster blamed the old man for the harrowing experience. The father replied, understandingly, "Tell me, son, how did you get away?" Whereupon the son recounted the events in detail, and the father finally smiled and said, "There, son, you have now learnt the art of burglary." This would get into a whole new discussion about, again, the role of parents in fostering children, their own resourcefulness, and their own perseverance in the face of adversity. I'm always skittish about talking about parenting because I'm not one. Even though I've read many articles decrying certain tendencies in parenting, overprotectiveness, this is the job of both parents and teachers to test, to require the student to find his or her own resources and face this crucible of discouragement and press on. All right, now we will recite the four vows. All beings without number,
I bow to the great endless divine passions. I bow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to impassioned, I bow to a brute dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gaze beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha.